All
All
right.
right.
Good
Good
morning.
morning.
I'd
I'd
like
like
to
to
welcome
welcome
you
you
all
all
to
to
the
the
Board
Board
of
of
Directors
Directors
meeting
meeting
for
for
Altus
Altus
Institute
Institute
of
of
Southern
Southern
California
California
Nonprofit
Nonprofit
Board,
Board,
which
which
operates
operates
Adeo
Adeo
Charter
Charter
School
School
2,
2,
Adeo
Adeo
Charter
Charter
School
School
3,
3,
Adeo
Adeo
Valley
Valley
Charter
Charter
School,
School,
Grossmont
Grossmont
Secondary,
Secondary,
and
and
Mirror
Mirror
Secondary,
Secondary,
and
and
Sweetwater
Sweetwater
Secondary.
Secondary.
I'm
I'm
Waylon
Waylon
Myers,
Myers,
Chairman
Chairman
of
of
the
the
Board,
Board,
and
and
I
I
will
will
facilitate
facilitate
the
the
meeting.
meeting.
Let's
Let's
take
take
the
the
role
role
first.
first.
Can
Can
I
I
call
call
your
your
name,
name,
please,
please,
provide
provide
a
a
brief
brief
introduction
introduction
to
to
the
the
benefit
benefit
of
of
new
new
members
members
and
and
members
members
of
of
the
the
public?
public?
Chris
Chris
Gordon.
Gordon.
This is
Chris
Chris
Gordon,
Gordon,
founder
founder
of
of
Re3
Re3
Gifts
Gifts
and
and
present.
present.
Thanks,
Thanks,
Waylon.
Waylon.
And
And
Jim
Jim
Purr.
Purr.
Jim
Jim
Purr,
Purr,
president
president
of
of
Paramount
Paramount
Hall.
Hall.
And
And
Christina
Christina
Stevens.
Stevens.
Christina
Christina
Stevens,
Stevens.
training
And
NSAFE
coordinator
coordinator
in
college
college
and
and
track.
And
And
I'm
I'm
Waylon
Waylon
Myers,
Myers,
Chairman
Chairman
of
of
the
the
Board
Board
and
and
CEO
CEO
of
of
Myers
Myers
Media
Media
Group.
Group.
All
All
right.
right.
And
And
Barry,
Barry,
would
would
you
you
like
like
to
to
introduce
introduce
any
any
staff
staff
present
present
at
at
the
the
meeting,
meeting,
including
including
General
General
Counsel
Counsel
Paul
Paul
Minnie?
Minnie?
I think everyone knows Paul Minnie, our counsel. And I think they're familiar with everybody. They know all the board members. We're good.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
All
So
right. So
quorum
quorum
has been established.
established.
Do I
Do I
have
have
a
a
motion
motion
for
for
approval
approval
of
of
3?
three?
I need one
one
of
of
the board
board
members.
members.
Motion
Motion
for approval
approval
item
item
1.3.
1.3.
Chris Gordon,
Gordon,
motion
motion
to
to
approve
approve
item
item
1.3.
1.3.
And
And
Jim
Jim
Purr,
Purr,
I
I
second
second
the
the
motion
motion
to
to
approve
approve
item
item
1.3.
1.3.
Thank you,
Jim.
Jim.
Okay.
Okay.
Voting
via
via
roll
roll
call.
All
those
those
in
in
favor
favor
say
say
aye.
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 No
No or
abstain.
abstain.
Chris
Chris Gordon,
Gordon,
your
your
vote.
vote.
Chris Gordon,
Gordon,
aye.
aye.
Jim
Jim
Herr.
Herr.
Jim
Jim
Herr,
Herr,
aye.
aye.
Christina Stevens.
Christina
Stevens,
aye.
And
Waylon
Myers
Myers
votes
votes
aye.
aye.
Now
it's
time for the
time
Pledge
for
of
the
Allegiance.
Allegiance.
You all please
stand.
Or sit.
Ready?
Ready?
Begin.
Begin.
I
pledge of allegiance
to the
flag
of
the United States of America, and to the republic,
indivisible, with liberty and
justice for all.
All right, we're moving on to the approval of the agenda. Item 1.5, do I have a motion for approval of, with recommendation from Mary Bixby? Mary, you approve the agenda?
Yes, I'm just Joey. I'm on. Yes, I approve, please.
Okay.
Recommend approval.
Okay, may I have a motion for approval?
Chris
Gordon,
Gordon,
motion
to approve
item
1.5.
Okay.
Why
don't
we
switch
back
and forth between Christina and Jim for the
second
and Chris for the motions, just to keep it simple, unless, of course, you don't want to approve. All right.
Sounds
we'll
good.
Conduct the voting via roll call. All those in favor say aye. Chris Gordon, your vote.
Chris Gordon, aye.
Jim Herr, your vote.
Jim Herr, aye.
Christina Stevens, your vote.
Christina Stevens, aye.
And Waylon Myers votes aye. And finally, my headset is behaving. I can actually listen to you again. All right. Time for a public comment, section 2.0. Public comment for items of interest to the public and within the scope of Altus Schools Southern California Board non-agenda shall be no longer than 2 minutes. Public comment for agenda items should be no longer than 3 minutes. Speakers may not yield their time. In meetings held over Zoom, any person who wishes to make a comment on either non-agenda or agenda items shall use the raise hand feature of Zoom to notify the board. In accordance with the Brown Act, no discussion or action may occur at this time, but it is the board's prerogative to respond or give direction to staff. All public comment will be heard at this point in the agenda as ordered below, and each agenda item being commented on will have a maximum of 20 minutes allotted, and each non-agenda item will have a maximum of 10 minutes allotted. If necessary, the board chair may equivalently decrease the time for each speaker in order to stay within the allotted maximum. Section 2.1, non-agenda public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items not on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to, I think it's 2 minutes per person, as it was said before, and this item is limited to 20 minutes unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Are there any public comments on items not on the agenda? Okay, I don't see any on the screen here, so we'll move on to section 2.2. Items, agenda items, public comment. This is an opportunity for members of the public to speak to the board on items that appear on the agenda. Speakers will be limited to 3 minutes per speaker, and this item is limited to 20 minutes, unless otherwise modified by the chairperson. Are there any public comments on agenda items? All right, I don't see any hands raised. Let's move on then. Section 3.0, the board workshop and training. Young, Minnie and Core Law Firm will be providing the comprehensive professional development training to the board on best practices in charter schools, board management, including fiduciary duties and fiscal oversight, the Brown Act and conflict of interest laws, and critical case updates and new laws affecting charter schools. Should I turn this over to Paul, or there's no instructions here for me?
Sure, I'm happy to take it from here, Board Chair. Good morning, everybody. Thank Happy November 1st. Everybody had fun during the holiday last night. Again, I'm Paul Minnie. I'm joined by my colleague, Kayla Haidu. And we have been asked and have the privilege of presenting a two-part comprehensive board training. The first part today will cover the Brown Act, the state's open meetings laws, and the California provisions regarding conflicts of interest. And then on the second day, I think it's about the same time on November 13th, I'll be going over the board governance best practices, new laws, critical case updates. As many of you have seen, a lot of legal issues and public policy issues being played out in public schools. So we'll be covering that during part two, which I'll cover. First part today will be covered by my colleague and senior counsel, Kayla Haidu, on the Brown Act. And we are recording, so it'll be distributed afterwards, as well as send around the PowerPoint presentation to everybody should they have any questions or comments. And if you do have questions during or comments during the presentation, don't hesitate to ask. I think we're runtime is just a little over an hour and a half, depending on how much Q&A. And with that, I'll turn it over to Kayla.
Thanks, Paul. Good morning, everyone. Happy to be here today. So we have our Alta Schools Comprehensive Board Training, as Paul just mentioned. A few disclaimers to get us going here. There we go. The training cannot substitute for personalized legal advice. We are in open session, so it's different than if we are talking one-on-one and we're under the protection of attorney-client privilege. That said, we do encourage questions. The third point here says that there will be a training. After the training, there will be a Q&A, but please feel free at any time to interject, ask any questions. We're good on time today. So we encourage you to ask questions as they go along with the understanding that, you know, that attorney-client privilege does not apply as it would if we were having a conversation after the fact one-on-one. Our advice is based on the latest available landscape, which is subject to change. The laws have in this area for the past few years been changing more and more. We have a law that we'll go over today that was just chaptered last month. So this is really, you know, at the forefront of the Brown Act and the conflict of interest that we'll see today. This is the, you know, Paul and I both are from YMC. We have these four missions. We're champions for outstanding choices in education for all of our students, all students in the state. We believe that a quality public education is a civil right, and we work and fight alongside you to ensure that students are always put first in everything that we're doing. A number of attorneys at this firm, myself included, were previously teachers. I spent 4 years as a fifth grade teacher at a charter school. So the good work that you all are doing really does matter to us on a personal level as well as a professional level. So we thank you all. I am Kayla Haidu, senior counsel. And of course, you all know Paul Minnie. And then Paul already broke this down for you, but essentially today we're going to cover the Brown Act and the conflict of interest. We'll get into the many nuances of both. And then when Paul returns on the 13th, he'll discuss board best practices and we'll go over some new laws and critical case updates. There's a number new cases that have happened in this past year, a number impacting First Amendment issues, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. They're incredibly interesting, and we're seeing a shift in the law. So we will discuss all of those with you in just a couple weeks' time. Today, we will focus on the Brown Act and conflict of interest. So understanding the Brown Act, this is where we're going to begin. These are the six questions that we're going to go over. Number one, what's the purpose of the act? Of course, understanding why the act exists and why it was implemented helps contextualize the act's many nuances, some of which are new. Two, what constitutes a meeting? This one is important too, as of course, understanding what qualifies as a meeting enables you to understand when you actually have to follow the act's legal requirements that we'll go over today. Three, what are the meeting notice and agenda requirements? Four, what are the public's rights at meetings? And spoiler alert, they have many rights. However, they're not without limits. So number five is those rights. You of course, they're closed sessions. There are times when you as a board are allowed or are required to go into closed session and discuss the matter confidentially. And the public is barred from access to those. And then what are the penalties for violating the act, and what are the remedies? How can we fix any violations? So that's kind of the breakdown of the Brown Act. After we go through everything in the Brown Act, we'll then turn to conflict of interest. All right, question one, what is the purpose of the act? So generally, the act is to foster broad public access. This is here quoted for you all. This is a specific definition. But what's really important to know is that the Brown Act is one of those laws that's in the spirit of sunshine and public transparency. So I always think that it's helpful to think about that fundamental purpose in determining what you can and can't do in each meeting. The bottom line of the Brown Act, the reason that it exists, is so that the public has access to your meetings and can have input, however limited, in the decisions that you make. So it essentially provides us with this mechanism by which members of the public know what you're planning to discuss at upcoming meetings. And can participate about the conversations that you all do have in those meetings. But at the same time, public access is not absolute. So it's something to think about in structuring your meetings, is where those nuances lie, so that you can determine where confidentiality is in fact allowed, despite this general scheme around public access. So we have, of course, these closed sessions. We're going to talk about closed sessions a few times today. This is just a snapshot list. We have personnel matter. These are things that can be statutorily authorized that allow the board to go into closed session. Personnel matters, labor negotiations, real property negotiations, receiving advice from your attorney. That usually comes in the context of anticipated litigation, if you believe that the school is going to be sued, or if you believe that if you intend to initiate litigation against another entity, or existing litigation. If you're already engaged in litigation, we often do closed session updates to keep the board apprised of where the litigation is going and the progress there. Public security also is allowed to be in closed session, and pupil discipline. And pupil discipline is an interesting one, because while the first six are or five are in the Brown Act itself, they're in the government code, pupil discipline is not. It's actually found in the education code, but you still are statutorily authorized to be in closed session. So just one quick note, outside of those areas, you can assume that public access is required and that the conversation is not subject to closed session. So how does, we know its purpose, to foster broad public access. How does it do that? How does it accomplish its purpose? First, the public is given notice of the meeting. We have those agenda posting requirements, 72 for a regular meeting, 24 hours for a special meeting, 1 hour for a very rare emergency meeting. The meetings often must also be open to the public. The confidentiality is limited. Those closed sessions, as we discussed, have to be statutorily authorized. But transparency does not mean chaos. The meetings are held in public, but they are not to be controlled by the public. And then just a last note here, a charter school is able to set more stringent requirements that make, that foster greater access and participation. We have seen this occasionally where some authorizers, some school districts themselves have a longer posting period required, and they then impose that requirement on their charter schools as well. So think about your charter, your bylaws, MOUs to see if any of your requirements are more stringent. That's not the case here, but that's generally our advice. Okay, what constitutes a board meeting? This is our basic definition. A meeting occurs when any congregation of a majority of the members of the body meet to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action. That underlined portion is statutory language. We'll see it come up a couple times today on any item of school business. So that when that is happening, that is a meeting. But of course, there are some basic exceptions. Certainly a majority of you all can attend a public conference of general interest. We have a few large charter school conferences in our state, and we have definitely seen board members attend those conferences, learn more about charters, get invested in the ongoings, and so that can absolutely happen, and that is fine. Also, attendance of a majority at other bodies' public meeting. This is the one that we see very often. If your charter's up for renewal, for example, a majority of your board might show up to the county or the district meeting to show support for your school and see that board's discussion of your charter renewal. And if you make public comment at that meeting, which you can do, other members of the public are there and they can hear you because that meeting is open itself. That meeting itself is subject to Brown Act. So that basic transparency threshold is still met. Also, ceremonial gatherings, think graduation, award ceremonies. The major caveat with all of these being that school business cannot be discussed. So if you are in attendance, I think where this we risk this the most is being at another public body's meeting when your charter is being discussed. It would be natural to, if a majority of you all are there, to leave and want to talk about what was discussed. You cannot do that. So you need to be careful, you know, no conversations in the parking lot on the way back to your cars. That's not allowed. That could easily constitute a meeting. Okay, what about committees? As a general rule, all committees have to follow the Brown Act. This is an area where we get a lot of questions. There's a lot of schools that have many committees, and most of those committees have to follow the Brown Act. For the most part, it does not matter whether the committee is permanent or whether it's temporary, whether it's decision-making or just advisory, giving advice to the board, or whether it's created by charter ordinance resolution or a board's formal action. Regardless of those various things, generally, a committee does have to follow the Brown Act. So you would need to follow the posting requirements. You would need to follow the teleconferencing requirements. Everything that would be required of you in your general larger board meeting would be required of you as a committee in most cases. But of course, as with so many things in the law, there are some exceptions. So we'll get into that. Let's talk about standing committees. So a standing committee comply with the Brown Act, even if it's advisory and composed of members of the board that are less than a quorum. So a committee is a standing committee. So this is the definition of standing. If it has continuing subject matter jurisdiction, that means it's on the same topic for a number of different meetings, a period of time. We often see schools with finance committees, budget committees, various things of that nature. Has a meeting schedule fixed by charter, ordinance, resolution, or board's formal action? So it either can be a have continuing subject matter jurisdiction, like a budget committee, a facilities committee, or if the board takes action to approve any sort of committee. It can be a committee that's only meeting for a short amount of time to solve an issue or come up with something innovative. That could still be a committee if the board has taken formal action to have that be enacted. So the Brown Act applies regardless of whether the standing committee is composed solely of the board members or less than a quorum. So then it has some examples here, which I've already given: budget committee, facilities committee. Those are types of standing committees that we see most often, but any committee that's created by board formal action is a standing committee. So most standing committees are going to have to comply with the Brown Act, regardless of whether they're just advisory and regardless of whether they are less than a quorum. Okay, there is one exception for certain advisory committees that are not subject to the Brown Act. So in that case, a committee is not subject to the Brown Act if all of these things are true. One, it's advisory. It's not decision-making, so it doesn't actually have any authority giving advice to the larger board. Two, it's composed solely of the members of the board. So there's not a parent on the committee. There's not another community representative on the committee. It's just the board. The committee is less than a quorum of the board, so it's absolutely not the whole board, and does not meet the definition of quorum. And the committee is not a standing committee. So as we discussed, standing committees, they have continuing subject matter jurisdiction. They're talking about the same thing over a long period of time. Or a standing committee is also when the board has taken action to develop a subcommittee. So I'll just say on committees, usually they are, the Brown Act does apply. And so everything that the larger board is required to do, so too is the committee. Okay, when does a serial meeting occur? Serial meetings are prohibited. They are absolutely not allowed because they are basically doing the exact opposite of what you are supposed to be doing as a legislative body. So the elements, the definition of a serial meeting are as follows. It's anytime you have a majority of the board members, they're meeting outside a meeting using a series of communications of any kind, directly or through intermediaries, this is that same statutory language that we saw at the beginning: discuss, deliberate, or take action on any item of school business that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of the body, which is essentially going to be any item of school business. These are strictly prohibited. You cannot do this. Where we see this come up most often is with technology. Technology can result in meetings at times you might not expect. Think about email chains, text, social media, website postings, etc. That, you know, if the board is going back and forth, we just had this issue this week with a client who there were two board members who were going back and forth about an issue, and the entire board was copied, and that was a meeting. They were going back and forth in emails about this issue. It was contentious. It was not pleasant. And so there were like 10 emails back and forth between each other, and that was a serial meeting, and that is absolutely prohibited under the Brown Act. Additional limits on board communication. So there's also a limit on sharing board opinions and positions outside of agenda items. And so essentially what this is saying is that if a board member is talking to a member of the administration or staff, they can do so. Board members have a duty of care to the organization and absolutely can and should be asking questions of their administration and staff. However, that they cannot communicate that position to any other board members. So if they're talking to the administration, to the senior leaders about X topic, the senior leaders would have to be careful not to share that position with anyone else that is also on the board, because then essentially the administration would be being used as an intermediary, and that could be seen as a violation of the Brown Act.
Kayla, I had a quick question for you about the previous topic.
Yeah, please.
This is Wayland. If a serial meeting happens accidentally, like we go, oh, whoops, it looks like that might have just been a serial meeting.
Yeah.
How do we fix that? Can we fix that? Do we have to cover it in the next board meeting? Like, what do you do?
Yeah, so it depends on the what happened. I know that for this client in particular, we are going to agendize what they were discussing. Actually, both board members are going to be removed from the board because it was pretty bad. It was a pretty bad violation. Now, no action was actually taken. And so in that case, you know, it's one of those things that there's not really much that you can do in retrospect, like, you know, affirmatively going backwards. It's already happened. You can't, you know, put the mm-hmm. case back in the bag. And so in this situation, what we did is we had both board members removed, and we were going to agendize and have a proper meeting about the item. Thankfully, the item in question there was not, it's something that should have been agendized in the first, like it was something that should have been discussed by the board in general. So I think, you know, that's how we're solving the issue, but it's absolutely not ideal because it's really hard to go back and fix absent, you know, essentially telling the board members that they have to leave the board.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to switch focus a little bit. We are going to move into the world of virtual meetings, teleconferencing. It's become a little bit wild. It's become a little frustrating. It's become more onerous. So I want to get into it and what we need to do going forward. So the first one is standard teleconference meeting rules. So these have been around for a long, long time in the Brown Act. They came way before COVID. And essentially what they do is so long as the quorum of the board is still participating from the school's jurisdiction, meaning the county or counties in which the school operates, then certain members can participate remotely so long as all of these additional requirements are met. This means that in addition to everything that you normally do under the Brown Act, you also have to do these. First, the agenda has to be posted at all teleconference locations. So that means that if you are teleconferencing from, say, a hotel, you have to post the agenda at that hotel and, you know, somewhere prominent, somewhere like in the lobby. You also vitally, each teleconference specific location has to be posted. So of course you have to have the address of the hotel, and you also have to have the room number where you will be doing the teleconferencing so that members of the public can participate in the meeting from that location if they so desire. Also, all votes have to be taken by roll call, and each teleconference location has to be accessible to the public. And if you're teleconferencing from, we see this come up the most often with ADA compliance. That's why we noted it here specifically on this slide. If teleconferencing from the second story of your house, for example, like most of us, you know, if we have two stories, we have stairs, not an elevator, that can be problematic under these rules because it's not ADA accessible. Members of the public also must be able to hear and must have a right to address the board directly from each teleconference location, which again means that if you are doing the board meeting from a hotel, the public has a right to come to wherever you are and participate from the meeting in that location under these rules. And then this one I already mentioned, all of this is only applicable if we still have a quorum of the board participating from the school's jurisdiction. So we can't have every single board member, you know, off on a vacation outside of the jurisdiction, all of them teleconferencing in. A quorum still has to be there within that jurisdiction. Okay, so those were the six normal teleconferencing rules. And they've been in the Brown Act for years and years and years. March 2020, of course, everything changed. Governor Newsom came in. He used his authority under the Emergency Services Act to waive most of the requirements for teleconferencing. After that, we got a bill that allowed for virtual trainings for a period of time. All that has now expired. So what's left is the traditional teleconferencing rules, which I just discussed, and some new and frankly pretty confusing and onerous laws that allow for virtual attendance, but only under certain circumstances. So this is the new law, AB 2449. It's a complicated bill. There are a lot of requirements to exercise the flexibility. So let's go ahead and walk through it. First thing to keep in mind about this flexibility is that it's only available in two circumstances: one, personal emergencies, and two, for just cause. The statute does expressly define what each of those mean. So I'll go over those in a little bit, but just know that if you are going to use this, you can only be using this for virtual emergencies and for just cause. It does allow, if you do have this virtual emergency or you do have this just cause, you can teleconference in without any obligation to identify the teleconferencing location on the agenda, and no obligation to allow public access to that location. So it is less invasive than the traditional teleconferencing rules, which do require both of those things. However, unlike under the teleconferencing rules, in AB 2449, to the extent that you are using one of these exceptions, you have to still participate through both audio and visual technology. That means we have to see and hear you as a board member. You can't have your camera off. You can't be taking it in the car. I mean, I guess you could, as long as your camera was on. You have to be participating through both. Okay, so here's the definitions of both. Emergency circumstances, it's pretty broad, pretty vague, means a physical or family medical emergency that prevents a member from attending in person. That is vague on purpose. It allows a number of circumstances to fall into that. It doesn't require, for instance, hospitalization or any particular level of emergency. It leaves it up to you to decide whether you or your family has an emergency that would prevent you from attending. And then just cause is any of the following. This one is more explicit. It's if you have childcare needs or you're caregiving for a parent, grandparent, grandchild, sibling, spouse, domestic partner, that requires you to participate remotely for any reason. If you have a contagious illness, if you have a need related to a physical or a mental disability that's not otherwise accommodated in the law, and or if you're on travel while on official business of the governing board. We've had some board members go to various events, various conferences to learn more about the school and the process. And if you are on travel, then that could be a just cause for attending remotely. Teleconferencing based on emergency requires that the member shall make a request. So this is only for an emergency. You don't actually have to do this for just cause. Make a request to participate remotely as soon as possible. So to the extent that you know that emergency is coming, as soon as that emergency happens, if you know you have a board meeting, you should be, to the extent you're capable, making that request to participate remotely as soon as you can. You also have to make a separate request for each meeting. So it can't just be like a standing, you know, I'm going to be on this emergency for the next three meetings. You have to do it separately for each meeting. If the request does not allow sufficient time to place proposed action on the agenda, because for this one, and as I'll talk about in a second, the board has to approve your request to participate on an emergency basis. If you have to make that request and you it's a regular meeting and the emergency happens one day before the meeting, the agenda's already been posted because it's a regular meeting, so it was posted 72 hours before the meeting begins, that's okay. The board can still take action at the beginning of the meeting. So it's one of those very rare times where the board can take action on something that is not on the agenda. Now, the utility of these is pretty limited because there are these extremely intense caps. So just cause can only be used twice per calendar year. So just twice. And then for either one, for emergency circumstances, the board has to vote to approve. And the if they make the request prior to the agenda being published and posted, the agenda should put on there that board member X is going to be participating remotely under the emergency circumstances exception. You do have to include a limited agenda item if you know in time. That agenda description does not mean that you should be giving out any personal information about that board member. It can be very high level, very broad. And then under no circumstance can a member participate in meetings solely by video conferencing from a remote location. Under this law, teleconferencing under the traditional rules does not have this cap. But under this law, you cannot do it for either reason for more than 3 consecutive months, for more than 20% of the regular meetings within a calendar year, or more than 2 meetings if the board meets fewer than 10 times per year. So there's this cap, which makes its utility, a lot less. There's also these other requirements. With this one, at least a quorum of the members must participate in person from a singular physical location that's clearly identified on the agenda, that's open to the public, and within your jurisdiction. So this one is interesting. This is more onerous than the traditional teleconferencing rules that require the quorum of the board to be participating within the jurisdiction. This actually has a quorum of the members participating from the same place. So it can't just be members are all spread out over the jurisdiction and their various homes at their various places of work, et cetera. This is the majority of the members are together. Members of the public, if you're using one of these, also have to be provided with a means to remotely hear and visually observe the meeting and remotely address the governing board. What this means in layman's terms is that essentially you need to be providing a Zoom link so that people can come into your meeting and participate remotely. It should one of your board members want to exercise one of these two options. What we are suggesting,
so just to be clear, sorry, that means that we now need to start getting together at least 2 of us in one place, or am I missing that?
Yeah, how many, if somebody's using this exception, yes. How many board members do you have in total? Is it 4?
4, I believe, right now.
4, okay, yeah. So you would want, if somebody was using this, then yes, you would want to be in one singular physical location. Now, you all could participate remotely under the traditional teleconferencing rules if you follow all those additional requirements, post your location, okay. Allow. Yeah, you could all do that so long as wherever you are is within the county or counties that your school serves.
Right. Okay. Yeah, so I think most of all of us are.
Yeah, just for this one, you have to be in one physical location.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. On this second point, what we're recommending is in case one of your board members wants to use this, we suggest that you put a Zoom link for all of your meetings on every agenda. So that, because if a board member wants to use this, but you don't have a Zoom link on your agenda, meaning that the public does not know how to remotely access the meeting, it would mean that you cannot appear, they cannot appear under these two exceptions. So best practice would be just on every agenda, put the remote, the Zoom link on there. Okay, the agenda must also provide notice of how the public can access the meeting and provide public comment. These are just general rules, cannot require public comments to be submitted in advance. If you are appearing remotely, and if somebody's appearing remotely and the broadcast, that Zoom link and the broadcast is disrupted for any reason, maybe there's a blackout, maybe power shut down, whatever it is, you have to stop the meeting until you can get it resumed, until you can get that resolved. The meeting cannot go on. This last one is just weird. This is not a requirement under any other teleconferencing rules that we've seen so far. Basically what this says is that if you are participating under just cause or emergency circumstances, and there's somebody in the room who is 18 or older, you have to tell the board who is in the room with you, as well as the nature of your relationship with that person. So that's just, you know, kind of an oddity in this law. Okay, and this is the law that was just chaptered. It was just chaptered on October 8th, so less than a month ago, just a few weeks ago, AB 557. So what AB 557 does is just to back up, I'll start with the second point. We saw a lot of bills this legislative session responding to the world coming out of the pandemic and having gotten used to some of the pandemic's conveniences. A lot of board members that we have seen do not want to appear in person. They want to be able to participate remotely. And it expands the capability of board members to really participate and to join boards if they are allowed these flexibilities. So this legislative session, we saw a lot of effort to try to increase the ability to participate remotely. Unfortunately, the vast majority of them were not chaptered. They did not become law. And however, we got one, it's a little bit helpful, but not that much. Basically what it does is it eliminates the sunset date for allowing schools to use teleconferencing without complying with traditional teleconferencing requirements during a proclaimed state of emergency. Currently, right now, we still technically have AB 361 in place until January 1st, 2024. That law, as you all may remember, it specifically allowed local agencies to use teleconferencing without complying with specified Brown Act restrictions in certain declared state emergencies. Its utility has been gone since February when the state declared emergency for COVID ended. Since then, AB 361 hasn't mattered. It hasn't meant anything. We couldn't do anything under that because we didn't have the state of emergency. But AB 557 would eliminate that sunset date so that legislative bodies, so that the board can use the state of emergency and operate remotely on a permanent basis. And though, you know, I think that we're unlikely to have a state of emergency again for COVID, there are a lot of other reasons that we are sometimes declared as in a state of emergency. The most often is wildfires, but we've also had emergencies, state declared emergencies for earthquakes or just other public health circumstances. So AB 557, what it would do is if there's a state of emergency that's proclaimed by the state for anything, not just COVID, then the board could participate remotely during the duration of that emergency. All right, next topic. What are the meeting notice and agenda requirements? So the golden rule here is that with limited exceptions, if it's not in the agenda, the board cannot discuss it. This bears on that transparency, sunshiny requirements of the Brown Act. The technical rule is here, the agenda shall be posted properly in advance of the meeting and must include a brief description of the items to be transacted or discussed. A couple weeks ago, I got a question from a school about, you know, what does brief description actually mean? What we generally say there is you want to give an indication to the public of what's going to be discussed at the meeting. So 20 words or less, you know, 20 often being too many, would be a fine for a brief description. It's just basically to give the public an understanding of what's to come. Okay, there are some limited exceptions when the board can discuss a non-agenda item, but they are exceptionally rare and they're rarely authorized. So the first one is emergency situations. And this is like a dire emergency, public health crisis, school has to shut down, et cetera. It's something incredibly serious that you can't even wait for the 1 hour emergency meeting that we'll discuss in a bit. Then you can talk about something that's not on the agenda. This is, again, extremely rare. The second one is continued matters. The agenda was posted for a prior meeting of the board that was not more than 5 calendar days before. And at the prior meeting, when the action was taken to continue it, there was action saying, we're going to continue this into the next meeting. In that situation, you do not have to re-agendize it, technically. However, if you know that you're going to discuss something at the next meeting, put it on the agenda. Even though technically you could get away with not, it's just best practice just to do it if you know that it's going to be discussed. All right, you can also give direction to staff. We've seen this before. If you know you're talking about an agendized item and then you have to give staff a direction that is off agenda, you know, that's okay. Again, we want to make that limited though. Brief responses, clarifying questions, announcements. Again, very limited, very rare. Identification of future agenda items. This is the one that I see come up most often. I've been at a meeting where during public comment on non-agenda items, a parent comes and they say, I want you all to discuss XYZ at your next board meeting because I have a concern about blah, blah, blah. Absolutely, the board is able and authorized to tell staff, you know, please put that on our next agenda item without any discussion of that at the time. You just want to say, we'll agendize this for next time. Okay, let's talk for a minute about board interaction with the public on items that actually are agendized. So technically the board can briefly interact with the public on agenda items beyond just receiving input. However, significant board interaction with the board, it's really not a best practice. I've been at meetings before where there is a very contentious situation between a parent and they're bringing something up. And it's really hard sometimes as a board member to sit idly by when you know that they are not fully informed, or you know that you have specific feedback to give them about their thoughts. It is sometimes hard to sit there and not give your thoughts. However, there are so many risks with engaging in the public on even agendized items, which we're going to talk about in a second, that generally what I recommend is just nodding and saying thank you, regardless of the content. Because these are the various risks. There are others, of course, as well. If you engage in a back and forth, you risk discussing topics that aren't actually on the agenda. You risk, because you know the conversation could just steer elsewhere. You risk this inefficient, chaotic, long meetings. You risk creating board indecision. You risk violations of board policies on complaints, and you risk violation of due process. So on the second to last one, often schools have specific complaint procedures that they are to follow. And if a parent or member of the public comes to the meeting and they're discussing maybe an issue with a teacher or something along those lines, and the board member engages with that, there may be a specific process that the school has already agreed to have in place on these types of complaints, and engaging in that manner can upset that process, basically. Okay, agenda posting requirements. So posting requirements vary according to the type of meeting. We have three types of meetings. The first is a regular meeting. That is has to be posted 72 hours in advance. 71 hours is not sufficient. It is not a compliant agenda. Special meetings, we have 24 hours, and emergency meetings, 1 hour. But this is really, really rare. Typically, dire emergencies, there's a crippling disaster, mass destruction, terrorist activity, something that is severely impacting public health, safety, or both. So we're not going to see that very often. Okay, where must the agenda be posted? It has to be posted in a few different places. First, it has to be physically posted in a publicly accessible location for the entire posting period within that jurisdiction, including teleconferencing locations, all school sites, resource centers, to the extent that that's applicable. If a charter school maintains a website, the agenda also has to be posted on that website. Basically, every charter school now does, so the agenda has to be there. And then in addition to just the normal spot on the website, the agenda also has to be on the homepage. You know, if we go to Grossmont's website, on that homepage, we want to be able to see with a prominent direct link the current agenda. And the agenda there has to be downloadable and searchable, and it has to be free access, meaning, you know, not only can it not be behind a paywall, of course, but you also can't require any like logging in or anything of that nature. I know that you all have that on your website, so we are good there. Okay, we're going back to closed session. We're gonna meet this again in a little bit, but there are six reasons that as we've discussed and we'll discuss again, why charter schools can meet in closed sessions for purposes of discussing certain items that are specifically allowed under the Brown Act to be discussed and not in the public. The default rule, of course, is you're always in open session unless the legislator has provided you with a very specific exception that details when you can meet in closed. When you do meet in closed session, a few tips for you. One, the legislator has included in the Brown Act this safe harbor language that can protect your school from challenges. That's why we call it the safe harbor, because the legislator has basically said, if you use our language and you fill in the blank, then people can't challenge you on your agenda language and claim that that item is insufficient, because we've provided you with that language, we've sanctioned that language, we're good to go there. The board chair also must provide oral notice, and that's as simple as the board chair just reading from the agenda, the safe harbor language that's on it. And then on this third one, the board has to make a public report of reportable action taken in closed session, and roll call vote or abstention of every member, if any. If no action was taken, of course, that's fine. You just, when you return to open session, which you should always do at the end of closed, even at the end of your meeting, you report out that no action was taken. Okay, a quick note on executive compensation. So I want to be very clear here. So approval of the CEO is always going to be brought to the board. And because of that, you have to follow these compensation rules. It has to occur at a regular, not a special meeting. It has to be before prior action is taken. The board must orally report a summary of the recommended final action, including the salary schedule, and fringe benefits during the open meeting where final action will be taken. The final action then has to be in open session. So that is always going to be true of the CEO. It is also true of the executive director and of any department head. If it's the school's operational status, if what the school does is if the school has the board look at, review the executive director and department heads' salaries and their salary schedules, then all of this has to be followed. So if their contract, if their employment agreement is brought to the board to be approved, to be ratified, because that's how operationally you as a school do it, then you have to follow these things. For the CEO, that's always going to be true. For an executive director and department head, if it is your practice, if it is your operation as a school to bring their contract as well, which we absolutely have schools that do, to the board, then you have to do that in a regular meeting. And then prior to final action, you have to do all of these things. And it has to be open. It has to, your final action has to be an open session. You have to put everything out there, salary, fringe benefits, salary schedule, et cetera. If it is your operational practice that only the CEO's salary and compensation is brought to the board, and the executive director and any department heads are brought to the CEO, then the board does not have to go through this for them. This is only in the situation where the board has a practice of approving these contracts. If the board is the one who's taking action there, then they have to go through all of these. All right, what are the public's rights at meetings? They have many. So what are the public's rights? They have a right to provide public testimony. So we're going to talk about addressing disruptive speakers, which we absolutely have heard, have experienced before, and also there's a new law on it. We also have taping or broadcasting. They can come in, they can tape your meeting, they can broadcast your meeting. There's also no conditions on attendance. There's can be non-discriminatory facilities, often, again, that ADA compliance comes into place. You have to provide copies of agendas and other public writing. And then you also must provide double the time for public testimony if they're utilizing a translator to interpret for them. Because of course, you know, so if you provide like 2 minutes for your speaking time, if they're translating, the translator is going to take some of that time. So anybody who's using a translator gets 4 minutes. So that, you know, that's all equal opportunity. Okay, we have this new law. So it was signed last August, and it became effective starting this January. And essentially what it does is it just provides clarity on the circumstances where a board can remove a member of the public with comfort that the law is behind them. So this adds a new section to the Brown Act, and it allows the board chair or the board chair's designee to remove an individual or to cause an individual's removal for disrupting a meeting. And we are going to define disruption just so that there is no confusion there. The law specifically defines it. Disrupting is, I mean, exactly what the common sense definition of it. It's actually disrupting, disturbing, impeding. It's basically rendering it impossible for the board to continue on with the meeting. These are a couple of circumstances that it includes, but it's not totally conclusive. So a failure to comply with reasonable and lawful regulations or policies adopted by the legislative body related to public comment. That means, in layman's terms, just speaking over the limit and not stopping. I've seen that at board meetings before, especially when it's contentious. A member of the public might come and they might be shouting and they might make it impossible for the board to continue. That would be disruptive. The second one is, of course, also disruptive. Engaging in behavior that constitutes use of force or a threat of force. So if anything is getting physical or they're making comments about it getting physical, that would be a situation that is absolutely being disruptive and could be cause for their removal.
So essentially, if that does happen and we're on a Zoom meeting, I can just say to the moderator of the Zoom meeting, like, you know, this is why we're doing this. This is person needs to be removed, and they would remove them.
Exactly. It's so much easier on a Zoom meeting than it is in person.
for sure.
Yeah. You do have to. So if there's a threat of force, that's actually the slide. If there's a threat of force, then you don't have to warn them. If there's not a threat of force, then you have to warn them. You have to say you are disrupting our meeting and your behavior is making it impossible for us to continue. If you do not discontinue what you're doing, you will be removed from the meeting. So you have to provide them with notice that they're going to be removed. On Zoom, you can then have the moderator remove them after you provide that notice. If you were in person, we do suggest that you don't do it yourself. We don't want anybody to get hurt. And then we also just don't want any liability issues should anything happen for the school.
Right.
So we recommend calling your local police if somebody is needs to be removed, or if you have security on campus, which some schools do, having them handle doing the removal.
Are the police bound to do that, though? Or can they say, sorry, he's not actually done anything and they won't do
they can
anything?
Say, yeah, they can say sorry. I mean, they can say, I'm not coming to that.
Right.
I do, you know, it. Yeah, they can. Yeah. You know, and then, you know, you would have to decide what to do. But, you know, I think depending on the circumstance, depending on the location, depending on the officer that you speak to, you know, they may be willing, especially, you know, if it's bad. But no, they're under no legal obligation to.
Okay.
True threat of force. So you do not have to warn for a true threat of force. True threat of force is defined in the statute. It's sufficient indicia of intent and seriousness that a reasonable observer would perceive it to be an actual threat to use force by making the person making the threat. Basically, you think that they are going to act on that and you have a reasonable, you're being reasonable in that assumption. That would be cause for removing them without any warning. Okay, so that's the new law. It helps protect the board. It helps protect your meetings. And it was written and chaptered with the intent to comport with constitutional limits of free speech under the First Amendment, which does not allow a person to be put into danger. So that's the law. Helps protect you, helps protect your meetings. Use it with caution. Use it when it's a serious disturbance. If it's 2 minutes and 30 seconds and they're still talking, that's not grounds to call the police. It's something where they're really being incredibly disruptive and your meeting cannot go on. All right, we're back to closed session. Authorized closed sessions, as we discussed earlier, include the following. Personnel, which is broadly defined as important appointment, evaluation, discipline, dismissal, or release of an employee. Now, we do have the caveat here that if you were going into closed session on a personnel matter, on one of those things, appointment, evaluation, discipline, dismissal, or release, the employee who is being discussed has to be given 24-hour written notice. If complaints and or charges against them will be heard. That's to protect their due process rights. We also have real estate negotiations. We also have labor negotiations, conference with legal counsel. This can be anticipated or existing litigation, public security, pupil discipline. You'll see a common theme here with personnel and pupil discipline. It's about the right to privacy. And then like real estate negotiations, labor negotiations, if that applied, that's about getting the best deal for the taxpayer, not putting your cards out. If you had to negotiate and put your, what your absolute top offer would be in open session, whoever was trying to contract with you, would see that and wouldn't accept anything less. So it's about getting the best rate for yourself. Okay, confidentiality requirements. No board member, staff member, or invitee may disclose information from closed session to anyone else without the explicit authorization of the board. Where we see this become a problem most often, it's not actually with the board, but other invitees who are in closed session and who may share something out of closed session. That's absolutely not allowed. There's closed session operates so that things will be confidential. And so they cannot be discussed outside of that forum. Okay, penalties and remedies for violating the Brown Act. So we have civil remedies. Board action can be declared null and void, which is a big deal. If you've taken action on something like a contract and you've entered into that contract and you all have gotten going on that contract and you've received the benefit of that contract or the other party has received the benefit from you, and it turns out that that contract was approved and there was a Brown Act violation during that approval, that can be declared null and void. So it can potentially be quite problematic. Also, injunctive relief may be obtained, and the prevailing plaintiff, if you all are sued for Brown Act violations, may be awarded attorney fees, which can quickly become quite expensive. And so it's potentially a serious violation. That's why we work really hard if we get a notice of a Brown Act violation to cure that violation. So that the charter school does not get sued, take action to fix it. Most often that means going back to the board meeting where something happened and there was inaction and there was a Brown Act violation and reapproving the things under, properly noticed agenda or whatever it was, fixing the problem and reapproving what was approved previously. Criminal penalties can also apply, though it's not too often that we see district attorneys pursuing this. The only time I have seen it over the years is predominantly when the district attorney is already pursuing the school for something else. If they also see Brown Act violations, they may also throw that in, but I've never seen a DA just on their own go after a school for a Brown Act violation. And then
is there a good time that we could take a is there a good time we could take a small break?
Yeah, of course. We can right now if you want, but I also only have two slides left before conflict of interest if we want to just
keep going. Yes.
Okay. What I was asking. Yeah. So potential charter revocation, that can also come up. Compliance with the laws is an area that your authorizer is responsible for ensuring. So a Brown Act violation is a violation of law. And so that can be problematic. And then, of course, shareholder stakeholder trust can also be problematic. And then the notice and demand for cure. So generally, a written demand for an alleged open session violation has to be made within 30 days. If not made within 30 days, there are some things that say that it must be made within 90 days. That means that if there's a violation and it was more than 3 months prior, more than 90 days prior, the window for anybody coming after you for that violation is gone. The board also must cure within 30 days if they are going to cure, or they have to notify the demanding party that it will not cure. And then the demanding party can initiate litigation to compel compliance if successful. So if they first issue the notice, they can then demand compliance through litigation, and then you may be awarded attorney's fees and court costs and all that. So, all right, this would be a great time to take a break. Waylon, how long of a break would you like to take?
Oh, I'm just thinking of like 2-3 minutes just for people to have a bio break if they need. It's a long meeting.
Yeah, sure thing. Okay, so maybe we'll come back at 11:45 or 43.
That's fine. It should be
okay.
Good.
Okay.
Thanks, everybody. All right. I'm back. I'm not sure if everybody else is. I think we have one more minute.
Sounds good.
All right, it's 11:45. I think we can resume if you are already.
Great. Okay, now we are going, you have finished the Brown Act training, and now we are going to move on to conflict of interest. So a conflict of interest, first step is, of course, understanding what it actually is, what it means. And they arise anytime you have a situation where a board member or an employee has some sort of private financial interest in a transaction that the charter school is engaging in. That's basically it. That might be a contract for goods, a contract for services. In either event, you have a circumstance where that board member or that employee then proceeds to participate in that discussion. That would be a conflict of interest. And just a quick note, the participation in that discussion is not only at a board meeting. That's something that we run into sometimes. It can occur at the very earliest stages of planning, even by throwing out the company, if you all are considering a number of companies, by putting in the ring of different companies that could be selected, one that you have a conflict with, that could constitute a conflict of interest. It's basically anytime the board or staff is trying to influence a decision, even at the earliest levels, that the agency ultimately makes. So it might be a decision to hire a particular company, or it might be that you are influencing the RFP process in some way. I worked on a project last year where that was very much the case. The request for proposal process had absolutely been a part of a conflict of interest. And so there was a conflict of interest violation in some way anyway, by designing a bid process that is going to essentially make like a particular company win out. Those sort of behind the scenes, putting your thumb on the scale, those are all violations of our state conflict of interest law. So something to watch out for there. So in short, as we have here, a conflict of interest is basically just a clash between an individual's duty to his or her office and his or her personal interest. So it's when those two things are overlap and are not aligned. Okay, so there are some common types of conflict of interest that are regulated by our conflict law specifically. We have ownership or investment in the business entity, investment in real property, source of income, source of gifts, effects on personal finances. And just a note there, as we have here, financial interests of immediate family members of the board members and employees typically are covered. So even if it's not helping you personally, if it is helping an immediate member of your family financially, then that would be covered. That would be a conflict of interest. So first step I'm going to talk about as we do this analysis, I always start with the most stringent law. That's Government Code Section 1090. And a violation of this law is a felony in the state of California. And there have been charter school board members who have been prosecuted under this statute. And so as we have here, it arises when you have a public official, an officer, a board member, or an employee entering into a contract where the public official has a financial interest in the contract. When all these things are the case, if it is a board member, the board is faced with an absolute bar to entering into the contract, unless an exception applies, which, you know, sometimes they do. The laws love exceptions. If it's an employee, that's actually where we see exceptions coming up the most. It may be a different circumstance in that they may be able, depending on the circumstance, to recuse themselves, meaning that the contract could go forward. We'll discuss that's a very fact-intensive process. And so it's a very fact-intensive determination. So that's something that we'd want to discuss on a case-by-case basis. Okay, what you need to know about Section 1090. So if a board member has a financial interest, the entire board is prohibited from entering into the contract, even if it was with the best vendor, even if it was at the best price, and the interested board member abstains, unless there's an exception, which, as I said, that's very fact-dependent. That's something we'd want to go on a case-by-case basis. And making a public contract is defined extremely broadly. As I mentioned before, it applies to the earliest discussions, planning, solicitation to bids, not just the ultimate vote. This statute is, in most respects, the toughest standard to meet. So we have 1090, and then we have the Political Reform Act, and then we have common law conflicts of interest. 1090 is the most stringent. It's the strictest. And as I also mentioned, a violation of 1090 is a felony, and it also renders the contract void. So incredibly serious, need to be incredibly careful there. Political Reform Act. So before we delve into this, I really just want to emphasize that we only get into this analysis under the Political Reform Act if you've managed to discover that there's an exception to 1090 that applied. If there's no exception to 1090, then the answer is full stop. We're not entering into the contract at all. So we're only here looking at this analysis of the Political Reform Act if some exception applies. The most common exception I see in our work is that sometimes some contracts that involve nonprofit corporations are treated a little bit differently than contracts with for-profit companies. So that's a distinction to look out for. But again, I'm not saying that you can count on the fact that every nonprofit scenario would be an exception to 1090. I want to underscore that. But to the extent that an exception does apply, it's probably often going to be the case that it involves a particular fact pattern that has a nonprofit agency. The best thing to do is, because it is so fact intensive, to discuss with legal counsel, go through who can go through all the exceptions and see if, you know, we can find one that exists. But assuming we have found one that exists, we're then in the Political Reform Act. So let's look at it. It's similar to 1090, as you'll see. It applies when there's a public official, and that includes charter school board members or its employees. And that public official is participating or attempting to influence a government decision. And that public official has a qualifying interest in doing so. And that includes, that qualifying interest includes spouse and children. The financial interest also on this one has to be material. that's not a requirement under 1090. There's no requirement that it be material. Any financial interest can be implicated, but under this one, it has to be material. If all of those things exist, then the official must recuse him or herself from all parts of the decision-making process. So Political Reform Act allows for recusal. 1090 does not. So regardless of whether you recuse yourself under 1090, if you have a financial interest and you meet all of those other requirements and there's not an exception, you cannot enter into the contract. That is not the case here. If these things exist, you can recuse yourself from the decision-making process. And then as we've noted here, there's lots of very detailed regulations that have been adopted by the FPPC, the Fair Political Practices Commission. They're the entity responsible for enforcement of any conflict of interest laws here in the state. And they are in charge of fining people who violate these laws. And they often coordinate with agencies who run criminal prosecutions related to these violations. So they're in it. It's very serious. One thing that's also covered by the Political Reform Act, in addition to just who can vote in a particular scenario, is the need to maintain the Conflict of Interest Code. So the Conflict of Interest Code specifies which employees at your charter school need to file and fill out and file this Form 700. Now, to be clear, all board members have to file a Form 700. That's automatic. But you as a board, you get to decide which board employees of yours are going to go out and fill, you're going to require to fill these Form 700s. There are some general guidelines, rules of thumb to keep in mind. They're generally, the board is going to require these of employees who are making decisions about the contracts that are going to be entered into. Or if some member of their immediate family has a financial interest in a contract that you know that you'll be looking into. That's generally when the board would require employees to also file the Form 700s. And then for those designated employees, it's also going to assign disclosure categories. So what I mean by that is there are numerous appendices on the Form 700. And depending on the nature of the person's job, you as a board might decide, okay, they only actually need to fill out blah, blah, blah portions of Form 700, not every single schedule. We see that a lot. So that'll be up to you all with the board in consultation with your attorneys on deciding, making that determination. Okay, but so for your Form 700, it has to be filed within 30 days of, as board members, within 30 days of assuming office or assuming your job at the charter school if you're an employee who has to also file these. And then after that, so once you do it initially, after that, then you also have to do it every year annually, and you have to do it by April 1st every year. And then you also have to do it, this is the one that gets people sometimes, you also have to do it within 30 days of leaving your office or your position, if you're a board member or an employee. There are penalties for failure to file. If it's deliberate, if you're intending not to file, it's not a mistake. In that sort of situation, you could face criminal charges brought by the attorney general or district attorney. Don't put yourself in that position. Of course, you don't want to be there. You also don't want to be in a position where the FPPC finds out that you have not filed your Form 700, because you do not want to be fined by them. They're one of these agencies whose revenue is generated by people that are fined. So they're incentivized to fine anyone who lands on their desk. It's just not a good place to be. So one question I get when I do these is, okay, I found myself out of these timelines. I did not file within 30 days. I didn't know, or I forgot, or whatever. And no one told me, you know, whatever it is, our advice is file your form now. Better now to go file the form than to have no form at all on file and have someone discover that you've not filed. And then it, of course, gives rise to an argument that you're deliberately failing to file. You know, that's just a tricky place to be. Okay. What financial interest means for Form 700 is defined exceptionally broadly. A lot is going to fall into financial interest. It's investment in a business entity of 2,000 or more. a real property investment of 2,000 or more, income of 500 or more. This is all, this is in a year, a business position in an entity, or a gift of $50 or more. There are gifts that are talked about a lot. We'll go over a few slides on them, but that's a low dollar amount for a gift, you know, potentially being a financial interest, although there are a lot of exceptions. Okay. Conflict of interest forms. They look and feel, so these are the Form 700s, they look and feel sort of like tax forms. However, on the back of each of these is actually something really helpful. It has charts of what you do need to report in X category and what you do not need to report in the category. So you can skip to the category that tells you what you do not need to report. So you don't need to report your financial interest, you do not need to report your residence. You do not need to report your income from a public agency. You do, however, have to report half of your spouse's income, and you also have to report any financial interest within your jurisdiction. So property is 2 miles within your jurisdiction, and jurisdiction is the county or counties your school's serving. Investments or business in jurisdiction, and gifts, all gifts inside or outside of jurisdiction. Those all have to be reported on your Form 700. Okay, gifts. I want to make sure we talk about gifts because they can become really problematic. The general rule is that you cannot accept more than $590 from one source in a calendar year. That was just increased $50 this past year.
That's a very strange, specific number.
I know, it really is. I know it's 540 before. How do they come up with these? I have no idea.
No idea.
Right. The general rule is also that gifts worth more than $50 have to be reported, and that's just one gift or aggregate gifts. So if you receive multiple gifts and they are add up to $50, you would have to report those. However, there are many, many exceptions to the gift. One, special occasions, birthday, holidays. These can be gifts from anyone if the gift giving and taking is proportional. So if you give gifts, they take gifts, and it's for a birthday or holiday, that does not need to be reported. However, unless they are a lobbyist. If they're a lobbyist, you cannot do any gift giving or taking with them. Don't accept any gifts from lobbyists. Don't give any gifts to lobbyists. The second one is inheritance. Third is family members. And even if your child is a lobbyist, you cannot be accepting gifts from them to exceed a certain amount. The same is true of long-term friendship. If you've been friends for a period of time, not defined in the law. The gift giving and taking has to be proportional. And then also dating, bona fide relationship, again, not defined. As long as they're not a lobbyist, you can return or you can, exchange gifts from them. One question that I get sometimes when I do this is, what do you do if you get a gift and you think, oh gosh, I don't feel comfortable with this because they're not any of these things. What do you do? What I recommend is that you send the gift back within 30 days. And then you're not going to have to report it. But if you keep that gift, even if you keep the gift and then donate it, that's a problem and you are going to have to report it. And if it's more than $590 worth of gifts in a calendar year, then that's not going to look good. And so we recommend giving those gifts back.
Yeah. How do you prove it to anybody that you've given it back? I mean, there's no receipt usually.
No.
That, right? Is it just your word against somebody else's word?
Yeah, essentially. And their word too. You know, if somebody gives you a gift and, you know, they're, I would think they probably wouldn't lie that you gave it back.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
A little loose there.
Right. Okay, so now we've talked through the circumstances of Government Code 1090. If you have a contract and it involves a board member, where that board member has a financial interest, then what are you going to do? you're not going to enter into that contract, even if the board member recuses. And even importantly, if the vendor is the best price, is the lowest price, even if they have the best quality service or good to sell to the school, if a board member has a financial interest under 1090, unless an exception applies, you cannot enter into that contract. If an exception applies, then you head over to the Political Reform Act that we just discussed, and your Form 700 disclosure obligations and gifts. If you get all the way through both of those, we still have one more thing to contend with, and that is the common law conflict of interest. There's a couple doctrines here that are important to know. So once you have a general prohibition against conflicts of interest, when you have one is you have a general prohibition against conflicts of interest, and that's a public official engaging in a transaction or influencing a decision, or even creating an appearance of impropriety, meaning like impropriety itself is not necessarily required, even if it's just an appearance. We also have the doctrine of incompatible offices. And what this does is this says that a public official cannot hold two public offices simultaneously if those offices are incompatible, because then their loyalties would be divided. You know, when you are a public official and you are holding public office, you are on a board, et cetera, you have a fiduciary duty to that entity that you're serving. If you are on an overlapping, in an overlapping jurisdiction, that could potentially create division in your loyalties, that would fall under the doctrine of incompatible offices and would be improper. Okay, we are almost to the end here, but we do first have a new law. So their existing laws is AB 2158. It essentially is going to require ethics training for board members. And the existing law has required board members and certain employees of cities and counties to engage in 2 hours of ethics training that is relevant to their public service every 2 years. Previously, charter schools were not required to abide by this law, but AB 2158 adds them in. So it means that charter schools are now added to the list of local agencies that have this every 2 year training requirement. And this was just signed by the governor last September. It became effective this year. However, there's a ramp up period for full compliance because people need to develop the ethics training, people need to take the ethics training, et cetera. So it's not until January 1st, 2026 that you actually have to get into compliance with this new law.
Does this kind of training, like in the corporate world, we have something similar. Is it kind of overlap like that? Can you just sign up for some company who's already offering it, or do you have to actually have this developed by your school?
You do not have to have it developed by your school. You do, as I'll talk about in a second, you do have to have it. Whatever training you're taking has to be done in consultation with the FPPC and the AG. So there's like specific requirements for that, but no, absolutely, your school doesn't have to develop it.
Right, gotcha.
Yeah. So ethics laws, they give us a lot of different things that you could take this ethics training on. You know, you can, you know, when you're selecting what sort of ethics training to do, you can tailor it to your school. It's something that you all would find interesting or important. It's things that we would expect. It's like, you know, laws relating to personal financial gain or prohibiting bribery, prohibiting conflict of interest. You know, there's still a lot of variety of things, prohibitions against gift of public funds. These are just several that they have listed, but there may be others as well. It is defined very broadly, and it's limited. It includes, but it's not limited to the following. So you really can do a number of different ethics that makes the most sense for your school. And also, it doesn't have to be the same every 2 years. You can change it up. Okay, so this is what I was just talking about with one thing that is interesting about this ethics training is that whatever's developed, the course that you're going to take has to be done in consultation with the FPPC and the AG. Consultation is not defined in the law, so I'm not entirely sure what that is going to look like. But essentially what eventually will happen is charter schools must provide their officials with information on how they can meet the training requirements. So you as a school may decide, you know, we're going with these three companies, or we're doing these three trainings, or we're doing trainings on these topics. Here's a few that you can choose from. And then, so you have to provide notice of that at least once a year. And then you want to maintain records for at least 5 years after the training was provided. That indicates the dates that it happened, who satisfied it, and the entities that provided the training. This is only applicable, it's not applicable to board members whose terms will expire before January 1st, 2026. All other board members, because you don't have to be in compliance until then anyway, all other board members seated as of January 1st, 2025 must receive the training required by January 1st, 2026. And then after that, they have to do it every 2 years. So you'll start in January 2025. If you have your board, whoever is seated then, they have to be trained by the following year, and then every 2 years after. Okay, that is it for me today. And on the 13th, when we come back, Paul is going to go over some board governance best practices, roles and responsibilities of the board and the administration. We did this for you all last year as well, but we have changed it up this year substantially just to make it more exciting, more interesting for everybody. So we have some board best practices, and then like we discussed at the beginning, we'll go over new cases and new laws that are applicable to charter schools. We have seen this kind of legislative trend over the last few years to make more and more laws applicable to charter schools. And this year was no different. So we do have a number of new laws that are coming. So this will give you all a great introduction into that. So that is all for me today. But if you all have any questions, I'm happy to answer anything.
No, I asked my questions along the way. I think that was really well done and very helpful. A couple of new things since the last time I took the training. Chris or Jim, do you guys have any questions?
No questions, very clear, and thanks so much for the time and preparation and going through it quickly as well.
Yeah, thank you.
No questions on my part either.
Tina?
No questions here. Excellent. All right, let's see. Back to the master agenda here.
Right. All right.
Section 4.0 board comments and announcements. From time to time, the board has topics that they would like to share with the community. These are informational in nature and do not require action. Just a reminder, we do have part two of the board workshop on best practices in charter schools, board management, including
fiduciary duties and fiscal oversight, the Brown Act and conflict of interest laws, and critical case updates and new laws affecting charter schools on Monday, November 13th, 2023 at 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. That's Pacific time. Any other comments from any of the board members? All right, we'll move on to adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn?
As Chris Gordon, and I motion to adjourn.
And a second.
Christina Stevens.
Everybody motions. Okay. Sounds good. Let's take a vote via roll call. All those in favor say aye to adjourn, or no, or abstain. Chris Gordon, your vote.
Chris Gordon, aye.
Jim Herr.
Jim Herr, aye.
Christina Stevens.
Christina Stevens, aye.
And Waylon Myers votes aye as well. The meeting is adjourned. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Paul, Mary, Kayla, everybody. It was really good.
Thank you all.
Thanks so much.
Have a great week.
You too.